This is Patient Care Theory 1, Unit 6, Part 5, Acute Coronary Syndromes. Okay, this is the fun stuff. It's exciting. Angina, heart attacks. This is fun. For you, for me, not for our patients. So try to hide your sense of glee when you're telling your family about calls you've been on. You know, try to take the sparkle out of your eyes and the grin off your face. So acute coronary syndromes are any conditions involving chest discomfort, signs and symptoms caused by a lack of blood flow to the myocardium. So ischemia being lack of blood flow resulting in hypoxic cells. So that includes angina, includes unstable angina, that includes non-ST elevation myocardial infarctions. So people can have infarcts but don't have any evidence on their 12-lead ECG, or ST segment elevation myocardial infarctions. We'll talk about that later. So the commonality is the pathophysiological path that these patients take. So the commonality is the things like atherosclerosis and plaque buildup within the arteries all leads to angina, unstable angina, acute myocardial infarcts, either STEMI or non-STEMI, impaired blood flow to the heart muscle, and in some cases it's a question of supply versus demand, where, you know, a patient at rest doesn't have chest pain, but if they, you know, take a brisk walk or try going on the treadmill, they develop chest pain, so they have angina that's brought on by exertion. That's why when it comes to the O of the OPQRC, we always want to know onset, when it started, and what were they doing at the time. Were they at rest? Were they exerting themselves? Was it mild exertion, significant exertion? We get heart attacks year-round, but some of the heart attacks we see in the winter are shoveling in the driveway, having an MI. This is why, you know, when you hit 40, it's probably time to get a snowblower and stop shoveling. You know, like, shoveling is not necessarily a good aerobic workout. We had a guy who had presumably had chest pain and then had a cardiac arrest on the roof of his house, traveling off the snow off his roof, and was like lying there on the shingles like a snow angel. And that's always nightmarish, trying to get them off the roof when they're like that. The other non-cardiac calls we get a lot of people falling off the ladders trying to put Christmas lights up. And usually the wife standing over top of them, chewing them out for getting up on the ladder, and we're trying to, you know, be the arbitrator between the wife and the guy with the fractured femur. So blood supply is inadequate to meet the heart's metabolic demands. Acute MI, the common etiology in an adult is they have a rupture of an atherosclerotic plaque. That's the most common etiology of a myocardial infarction in an adult. So they have this atherosclerosis and plaque formation. They have this bumpy tunica intima, and it generates turbulent blood flow, and that surface erodes over time and it ruptures. And it ruptures, when it ruptures, it's just like a cut or any kind of injury where you get platelets and clotting factors that rush into the site to try to control the bleeding, so that ruptured plaque. But when it happens inside an artery, the clot occludes arterial blood flow. So these patients end up infarcting. This is just a funny story for when it comes to using medical terminology. Obviously, we're not going to use medical terminology with our patients, but I'll just read it to you. It says, one day, I was a bearer of bad news and had to tell a wife that her husband had died from a massive myocardial infarction. 5 minutes later, she overheard her reporting to the family that he died from a massive internal fart. I don't know that I'd even go in the room and correct her, because that's just such a great story. Like, had your husband die a massive internal fart? I just think that's, like, that's the best story ever. So, angina, you know, that would be justification for letting it out, right? better out than in, as Shrek would say. So, angina. So usually, stable angina is usually precipitated by exercise or emotional stress. And so these are patients who have advanced coronary artery disease. And so the pain can last 1 to 5 minutes, occasionally as long as 15 minutes. And when they, when they're diagnosed with angina by their doctor, they're usually given a prescription of nitroglycerin and ASA, and they're told, take 3-nitro, and if you don't get relief from 3-nitro, call 911. So relieve with rest and nitro. Unstable would be onset at rest or with light exertion. And the pain can last 10 minutes or more. Relieve with rest, nitro, plus or minus O2, but not relieved as easily as stable angina. So angina typically presents with pain in the chest. Angina means pain. Angina pectoris is chest pain. You can get angina from a clot in your leg. You can get angina from a clot in your lungs. But when we say angina, we usually think of cardiac ischemia. So as I said, blood supply is inadequate to meet metabolic demand, so ischemia results, and usually from atherosclerosis. When it comes to the cardiogram, these are the sort of things we look for. So when a patient has an acute myocardial infarction, they oftentimes have ST segment elevation, and this is the ST segment here. They may or may not have inverted T waves. Inverted T waves actually can mean a number of things, just one of them being ischemia. And then Q waves, in order to be pathological, have to be at least a millimeter wide and should be at least 25% the height of the R wave. And they are indicative of necrosis. So when you're having an infarct, what happens is, we'll say you're having an infarct here. If you look at that, what we'd see is a loosely defined area. It's not a clearly demarcated area. It's not like a circle or something. And in that area, once blood flow stops, and it could take up a space here, it could take up a space, you know, here, a whole swath of area. It could take up a whole bunch of different areas. So what happens is we have ischemia happening. And over time, we start to develop areas of injury that I'll just make as an X. And what injury means is that the cells are ischemic to the point where they lose control of their permeability, and fluid starts to leak into the cells, and they become edematous. And when they become injured, we see the ST segment rising above the baseline. And then you start to get necrosis. And necrosis happens in patchy areas initially. And eventually, you know, if that area goes untreated, it becomes just one big area of necrosis. So when someone's having chest pain that's consistent with cardiac ischemia, if you're off duty and you encounter someone like this, like a family member, my first advice is call 911. Don't get into a debate with your mom or dad or your grandmother or your uncle. Just call 911 and tell them you've called 911. And if they don't want to go to the hospital, just say, well, you can have a conversation with the paramedics. And number two, know that the greatest risk of sudden death with a heart attack, and a heart attack is not the same as death, right? So remember, heart attack is myocardial infarction. The greatest risk of sudden death happens within the first 4 to 6 hours, and it still takes most people 4 to 6 hours before they make the decision to seek medical attention. So high risk of sudden death within that 4 to 6 hours. The risk of sudden death is actually about 5%, right? And it goes down over time. So it goes down at 12 hours, and then at 24 hours, and at 32 hours over time. But one of the reasons why they're high risk of death in this phase here, in the early onset, is because and we'll talk about this in more detail in the third semester, but when a wave of depolarization hits an area that's undergoing infarction, you're going to find cells that are unable to depolarize, and so the wave of depolarization will go around those areas of non-conductive tissue. But when they go around one side, they might find a block. The cells are still refractory. They're not able to conduct the impulse. But the impulse is able to travel around like this and off to the rest of the heart. But when it circles back around, it's able to get through that area slowly, milliseconds, we're talking milliseconds, and give rise to what we call a reentrant ectopic focus. That's called a re-entrant we'll say focus or impulse, or beat, like a premature beat. Okay. So you can get premature ventricular complexes happening from that ischemic injured area. You can get a ventricular tachycardia from that. You can get ventricular fibrillation. If you have enough reentrant foci in that area, you can get VF. So that's the reason for the risk of sudden death. And 72 hours later, that's just one big necrotic tissue that's electrically silent, so nothing gets through it. So the risk of death drops dramatically by the 72 hour period. But you wouldn't want to do that, because then you've got, you know, a myocardium with a big area of scar tissue. And scar tissue doesn't contract, right? So the rest of the muscle is contracting, but that scar tissue just sort of passively goes with it. And when it's not contracting, there's always the risk that on the endocardial surface, you can get clots forming. They call them mural thrombi. And if a thrombus forms on, you know, a wall where the patient's had an old infarct, that thrombus can dislodge, go to the brain, the lungs, wherever, most often to the brain, because it's coming off the left ventricle most often. And that's a problem. So our objective is to get people, as soon as they're having chest discomfort, diagnose an MI on the 12-lead ECG and get them to the cath lab where they can get angioplasty. Now, the cath lab here is going to open soon. So I'm hoping to not have my first infarct until the cath lab's open here, because otherwise I'd have to go all the way to Southlake. I've had so many patients with STEMIs. I think if I have my heart attack, I might be a little scared, but I won't be too worried, because I know that as long as I got the defib pads on me and as long as I'm going to a PCI center, it's all good. I'll just get, you know, they'll just break up the clot and leave a stent in place and open up my vessel. I'll be as good as I was when I was 58. So it's all good. So when a patient has a myocardial infarction, it evolves, right? Initially, they typically have just ST segment elevation. Over time, they begin to develop pathological QAs, unless we get them to the cath lab sooner. They develop pathological QAs. Days later, the ST segments come down to the baseline, but they may be left with pathological Q waves. And you'll encounter a lot of patients in the field who've had old inferior wall MIs, and they have no idea they've had a heart attack in the past. Because when you infarct your inferior left ventricle, oftentimes it presents with epigastric discomfort. They think they had indigestion, they felt weak for a week or so, they felt kind of crappy, maybe they thought they even had the flu, and then you come along 2 years later, you do a cardiogram, and you find an old inferior wall MI. You find pathological Q waves in the leads that reflect the inferior left ventricle. So those are some of the ECG changes, just a basic introduction. So myocardial infarction or necrosis, infarction means death. Excuse me. Definitions vary, but so we're looking for ECG changes consistent with ischemia MI, new Q waves. Evolving usually means pathological Q waves plus ST segment elevation. Old would be pathological Q waves, permanent Q waves. And as I say, we see people with old infarcts all the time. And if I look at the cardiogram and I see an old infarct, I'm not going to say to the patient, you know, if the patient says, I've never had a heart attack, I'm going to say, well, your cardiogram says otherwise, lady. Looky here. just not going to do that. It's not my job, not my role. If it was my mom, I would. Oh, Robert, how do you know for sure? Because I've been a paramedic for 34 years, damn it, Mom. Is that what you do? No. What's that? No, it never has. I'm kidding. No, she knows exactly what I do. She does. Prince Metals Angina. Prince Metals Angina. This is an interesting thing. This is a coronary vasospasm. It's a very uncommon occurrence. We don't see this very often. The last time I saw it was in a 22 or 23-year-old guy who had irritable bowel syndrome. You think not related, right? But he was on like a bag full of alternative remedies, and three of them contained ephedrine, which is a sympathomimetic, and he was having coronary vasospasm. And when they're having coronary vasospasm, they'll have crushing chest pain, just like angina or MI, and they'll even have ST segment elevation. And then when the chest pain goes away, the ST segment's coming back to the baseline. And that's what happened with him. I gave him ASA, like he's 22, 23. I'm thinking, boy, this guy's young for having an MI. But I gave him ASA, I gave him nitroglycerin, we took him to the hospital. The doc went through all these alternative remedies and said, yeah, I think, you know, because he's on this drug, this, or this thing, this thing, this thing, and they all contain ephedrine. That's probably why he's having a vasospastic angina. So just get rid of all that crap and he'd be good. So it's a focal coronary artery spasm. Most cases related to an abnormality of normal vasodilatory function or a hypersensitivity of the coronary vessels to normal mediators of vasoconstriction. They get ST elevation, they get tachycardic, sometimes bradycardic, can accompany episodes of prolonged chest pain. And they can have really significant ST segment elevation. So MI will typically present with heavy vice-like squeezing or pressure sensation in the chest, classically, but not everyone presents with the same thing. Some people just present with shortness of breath. I even had one guy who had sharp chest pain that he could point to. He's right here. And when I did a 12-lead ECG, he was having a ST segment elevation myocardial infarction. But those are the classic signs and symptoms, and the discomfort may be across the chest, or it may be epigastric, which means above the stomach, like at the xiphoid process, or substernal, which is below the sternum, which is also epigastric, or retrosternal, which means behind the sternum. It's typically described as constant, so if it comes and goes, it's more likely like a GI thing or something. Radiating pain oftentimes to the arm or the arms or the neck or the jaw can happen. Typical associated signs and symptoms and pertinent negatives would include, you know, they get a flight or flight response, so they're pale, cool, diaphoretic. They may be short of breath. If they're not short of breath, that would be a pertinent negative. They may have nausea and vomiting. If they don't have nausea and vomiting, that would be a pertinent negative. So I would say no shortness of breath, no nausea and vomiting. Diaphoresis is an important one for MI. Interesting thing. So diaphoresis has a high sensitivity for acute MI, but pretty much a zero specificity. Like if I told you got a 59-year-old who's sweaty and said, what's wrong with him? You could say, well, could be anything. You know, it could be a zillion things. So it's a very nonspecific sign, but it's highly sensitive for myocardial infarction in contrast with, say, angina or unstable angina. So important to ask, so important to determine, like, are they sweaty when you find them? If they're not and they're having chest discomfort, ask them, did you break out in a sweat when this started? And if they say yes, then it's just a little tiny piece of evidence that makes you think, okay, maybe this guy's having an infarction. We're going to do a 12-lead ECG, confirm it, but... anxiety would be another pertinent common finding. I wouldn't call it a pertinent negative. I would leave that out. You know. In terms of the O, when did it start? Was it sudden or gradual? Acute MIs are typically sudden, right? They rupture an atherosclerotic plaque. They have a sudden onset of discomfort. Was it exertional? Was it at rest? Is there anything that provokes or exacerbates it, like exertion? Is there anything that palliates it, makes it feel better? Is it provoked or not provoked by palpation? typically not provoked by palpation? Is it palliated by rest or nitroglycerin, or not palliated by position? In terms of the quality, again, usually heavy vise-like squeezing, pressure, epigastric or substernal or retrosternal. And then there are patients who have silent MIs, and those are typically patients who have MIs with no chest discomfort who are elderly or insulin-dependent diabetics. Because diabetes affects your peripheral nervous system, and they may have sort of degenerative peripheral nerves, so they may not present with chest pain. So if they look sick, and they're diabetic and they're a little older, do a cardiogram. You know, if I get someone even in their early 40s and they look like 10 pounds of dirt in a 5-pound bag, I'm going to do a cardiogram on them. You know what I mean? Like they're pale, clammy, and they look like crap, I'm going to do a cardiogram on them. Do they have any pain? So we want to know the region. We want to know if it's radiating to the arm, neck, or jaw. Rarely to the back. If it's to the back, we start to think thoracic aortic dissection. But you could have an MI with radiation to the back. Severity is subjective, right? But we want to get an idea what their pain is or their discomfort is on a pain scale. And timing, really what we want to know is it constant or is it intermittent? So if it comes and goes, it may be epigastric in nature, maybe peristaltic in nature. If it's constant, more likely angina or MI. And but if it lasts for, you know, 3-5 minutes or as much as 15 minutes and goes away, it could well be angina. So we talked about that already. So diaphoresis has a high sensitivity for MI. Shortness of breath, nausea, vomiting would also be common. Urge to have a bowel movement. Do we talk about this? Why might someone having a heart attack have an urge to have a bowel movement, do you think? It's not the pressure, no. No, Jake? No, it's not a referral issue. Yeah, they're scared shitless. That's exactly it. It's a sympathetic response. There you go. Yeah. They're just not shitless yet. And the question is, do I let them take a crap or not? And I tell you, I don't want to. And I don't know what it is, but I always seem to get chest pains at Tim Hortons and then want to go for a crapper. What's that? It's not the Tim's. And we're recording this, so be careful. You could be facing a lawsuit from Tim's. I mean, if you're having a heart attack, and you're having a big heart attack, and you feel like you're going to die, with a sympathetic response, with a catecholamine response, typically two things happen. You pee, or you want to pee, or you want to have a crap, right? That's what happens when you get a sympathetic surge. You know, it's funny, when people have a fight or flight response, and they pee themselves, for whatever reason, as a society, we associate that with cowardice. It's not cowardice. It's an involuntary thing. You know, you could jump out of your foxhole, crawl on your belly to your, you know, to an injured shoulder, a soldier rather, drag him back to the foxhole under gunfire, and get back to the foxhole, and you're soaking wet in your own urine. That's just an involuntary response. Certainly not an act of cowardice, right? So that happens. And people sometimes defecate, right? That's why I call it fight, flight, freeze, because some people get paralyzed with fear, or fecal expulsion, the four Fs, right? Fight, flight, freeze, feces. They crap themselves. So if I get someone having a heart attack or chest pain and they want to go for a crapper, it's like, oh, this is not good. It's like, and so what I'll say to them is, we're going to put a plastic sheet on the mat, on the stretcher, and you can just do it right here if you need to. Or we'll give them a plastic toilet seat to sit on. But I'll tell you, most often, you talk to them calmly, you get them on the stretcher, you put them on the monitor, you continue to reassure them, that urge to defecate goes away. It does. But I had a guy once who looked like he was going to die. He wasn't having an MI. He was a COPD exacerbation. And when we got into his house, as soon as he saw us, he stood up from his chair and he bolted to the bathroom and he sat on the toilet and had a big crap. And we had to go after him, right? Because the last thing I want him to do is go for a crap and have a crapper, you know, fall off the toilet and die. Because this is what happens to people, right? If they look like they're going to die, just anticipate they're going to die. And if they don't die, bonus. Yay. You didn't die. I love you. But anticipate they're going to die if they look like they're going to die. Anticipate they're going to die if they tell you they're going to die. And if they don't die, it's a good thing. But if you're thinking they're going to die, you're going to be prepared, right? You're going to think about unzipping the pouch where the defib pads are. You're going to be pulling out the BVM and everything else. So I go right in the toilet with him. While he's sitting on the toilet having crap, privacy doesn't matter anymore. I'm going to put my hands on his shoulder. I'm going to say, are you okay? And I say, if you have no objection, I'm going to stay here with you. I'm worried about you, right? You look like you're really struggling to breathe. Let's get some oxygen on you. If you don't mind, just go ahead and have your poop. And we'll take a blood pressure, pulse, and some other things. And then we'll disconnect you and let you finish up. Right? If you need some help, let me know. If I have to wipe someone's ass, I'll do it. I'll usually do it with a towel because it's a lot easier and avoids getting poop on my hands than using toilet paper. There's too much finesse involved in, you know, digging out the poop with a handful of Kleenex or toilet paper, right? You can do that yourself, but when it's someone else doing it, so towels are good for that. Urge to defecate is a bad sign. It should scare you, but try to hide your fear, right? Stoic, professional, calm. If you can convince them to stay on your stretcher to have a poop, it's not the most pleasant ride into the hospital, but it's better than having them die and slipping between the toilet and the wall or the stall, and they're in cardiac arrest, and now you're going to try to pull them out of there. Not a good experience. So with AMI, presentation can be exactly like angina, but lasts longer than 3 to 5 minutes, not completely relieved with rest nitroglycerin. People do crazy things with drugs. A guy's having chest pain, the neighbor has nitroglycerin, comes over, spray, 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 spray. We get there, the patient's unconscious. Because nitroglycerin is a vasodilator, the blood pressure drops, it drops, it drops until their brain is no longer perfused. Now we find them unconscious. Mm-hmm. We ask what happened. The neighbor came over, gave his nitroglycerin to the guy because he uses it for chest pain. The guy was having chest pain. So keep your brain open for anything and everything. Bizarre things happen. So treatment for MI until proven otherwise, or suspected MI until proven otherwise, is ASA and nitroglycerin for the most part. So SpO2 room air, plus or minus O2. With STEMIs, if they're saturating well and they're not short of breath, I don't give them oxygen anymore. ASA by mouth, they need to chew it and swallow it. It's an antithrombotic, so it keeps the clot from getting bigger. A thrombolytic, which they give in hospital, breaks up the clot. So that's a drug that breaks up the clot, but we give an antithrombotic. It limits the size of infarct, it increases survival. We put them on the ECG monitor the rhythm. We do a 12-lead ECG to rule out infarction or rule out right ventricular infarction. If they have an RV infarct, we don't give them nitroglycerin. I'll talk about that in more detail later, but you can still give them ASA. Nitroglycerin we give sublingual, it's a vasodilator, predominantly a venodilator. Reduces preload, improves collateral circulation. And if they're a STEMI, if we do a 12-lead and they're having an infarct, then we take them to a percutaneous coronary intervention center, PCI center. So let me go to the directives, the actual directives. And so for ASA, so the indications, suspected cardiac ischemia. I like that because it's vague. Vague is good in medicine. You'll hate it. You should hate it as a student because you want things that are clear, black and white, easy to work with. But medicine is gray. So if you've got chest discomfort or signs and symptoms you think might be an MI, we treat with ASA, and nitroglycerin just depends on whether their heart rate is normal range or whether they're normal tensive. The reason we don't treat with nitroglycerin if their heart rate is below 60 is because cardiac output is a function of stroke volume times heart rate, right? If their heart rate is low, we're going to be reducing their preload and therefore their stroke volume with nitroglycerin, which is a venodilator, and that could drop their blood pressure precipitously, so we don't give nitroglycerin. We also don't give nitroglycerin if their heart rate is in excess of 159. If I was going to pick those numbers, I'd probably say in excess of 140, because a person at rest should not have a heart rate above 140 or 150. If they do, it's probably not a sinus tachycardia, it's probably a supraventricular tachycardia, and we should be treating the tachycardia, because the tachycardia is probably causing the chest pain. So that's why they have those numbers, 60 to 159. Nitroglycerin is not likely to save anyone's life, so it's a symptom relief drug, it's helpful, it's a good thing, but if they're bradycardic or excessively tachycardic or they're hypotensive, it could be deleterious for them, so we just hold off on the nitro. Right? Contraindications, so nitro, one of the contraindications is phosphodiesterase inhibitors used within the last 48 hours. That's drugs like Viagra and Cialis. And so there were, I think, 16 case reports, 16 fatalities of patients who were on a phosphodiesterase inhibitor and got nitroglycerin. We don't know for certain if it was a nitro that caused the death, but we know that nitro and phosphodiesterase inhibitors have what they call a synergistic effect, meaning that instead of 1 plus 1 equaling 2, 1 plus 1 equals 3, so the combined drugs are worse than the sum of the two. And the risk is they have a precipitous drop in blood pressure that will not respond to fluids, will not respond to drugs to get that blood pressure up. So it's not worth the risk of giving nitroglycerin to someone on a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. So here's the thing. You get a patient with chest pain, and you see they're on prescription drugs, and you're thinking you're giving them nitroglycerin, but they're three prescription drugs you don't recognize. What are you gonna do? Give them nitro? What are you gonna do? Got three prescription drugs you don't recognize. Look them up, exactly, look them up. If you're gonna use your cell phone, tell them I'm using my cell phone to look up the drugs so they don't think that you're sexting. Right? Not now, honey. Shut it down. Oh, I looked them up in a pocketbook. I carried a pocketbook. Yeah, the prescription drug book. Yeah. But prescription drug books suck, right? They're big, they're thick, they're heavy, they go out of date. Like the minute they're published, they're out of date. Smartphone's the best thing ever. Cell phone. I had a flip phone for a long time, and staff here were teasing me for having a flip phone. So I had to go to my wife and beg for a smartphone because they were teasing me. But yeah, look it up. So you should have a drug app, or two drug apps, or three drug apps. I think I have four. Medscape's a good one, Drug Bank's a good one, it's a Canadian one, but you got to look up those drugs. Now, erectile dysfunction drugs or phosphodiesterase inhibitors used to leave me with haunting images, because you get this old guy who's hunchback and his skin's falling apart and he looks terrible, he looks near death, and you go through his meds and you see Viagra, it leaves you with a haunting image. But now, a lot of guys, a lot of men with benign prostatic hyperplasia, so they have an enlarged prostate and it's not cancerous, they go on Cialis, which shrinks the prostate. So now I see old guys on Cialis and no more haunting images, which is a really good thing. I thought there was like a sex epidemic happening in Burlington because I saw all these men suddenly on Cialis, and then like talking to nursing staff saying, look, what the hell's going on here? Is there like a swingers club for seniors somewhere around here? And they said, oh no, Rob, it's the docs here just prescribe it for benign prostatic hyperplasia. I said, oh, thank God. So I'm telling you, naked old people will leave you with more haunting images than the traumatized patients, you know, the open fractures and the eviscerations and things like that. It's naked. Old people, they're like babies, right? They run around naked. It's like, oh, like put some underwear on, please, something. It's really disturbing. So another contraindication for nitroglycerin would be a right ventricular infarct, and that's because it's a venodilator, and someone with an RV infarct is very dependent on adequate preload, right, to stretch the right side of the heart to increase contractility. So the last thing we want to do is give a venodilator with someone who's having an RV infarct. And ASA, you can read those contraindications on your own. What else? So treatment, ASA, we give them 2 tablets. They're typically 80 milligrams apiece or 81 milligrams apiece, hence the 160 to 162. We give them a single dose. We have them chew it and swallow. And it's not uncommon for them to take an ASA before we get there, but the protocol is still we give them ASA again. For STEMIs, for nitroglycerin, if they've got a pressure of at least 100 systolic, you can give 0.3 to 0.4 milligrams every 5 minutes to a max of 6. If they're not a STEMI, if they are a STEMI, they got a systolic of at least 100, you can give it sublingual, again, 0.4 milligrams every 5 minutes to a maximum of 3. So STEMI, they get 3, non-STEMI, they get 6. That's a recent change in the medical directives. We'll talk about RFE infarcts in more detail later on in the program, but that's it for that for now. Any questions about angina and MI? Yeah.
So I think I just missed some things.
Sure.
Just connecting it all. So an infarction.
Yeah.
Is dead tissue or a blockage?
Yeah, it's dead tissue that results from a blockage. Yeah.
So the block. So ischemia.
Yeah.
Is caused by a blockage.
So ischemia can be either blockage or partial blockage.
Okay.
So you can get ischemia from angina where you've got atherosclerosis and, you know, you have a brisk walk and you develop chest pain, but then when you sit down, you're at rest and your demands diminish, the chest pain goes away. So it's not it's just a partial blockage, if you will, with angina.
Angina means chest pain?
Yeah, it means pain. Pain from ischemia. Yeah. So you can have leg angina. If you had a clot in your leg and it was you were getting inadequate blood flow to an area, you could have. But when we say angina, we're almost always talking about angina pectoris. So
you're saying angina, if the angina is related to the myocardial infarction?
No. So there are two different things, right? They're having angina or they're having an MI. If they're having an MI, they should have signs of that on a 12-lead ECG. So we should see ST segment elevation if they're having a myocardial infarction. So myocardial infarction would be a total occlusion of the artery or a near occlusion, like 28-29% of the artery, whereas angina might be just a partial obstruction of the artery and the chest discomfort is temporary, right? So it's either stable angina where they get chest pain on exertion and it's relieved quickly when they rest or maybe with some nitro, or unstable angina where they get chest pain at rest or with minimal exertion and they just need rest and nitro for it. But an MI would be a complete occlusion or a near occlusion, and that's almost always rupture of an atherosclerotic plaque and a clot formation.
Oh.
Yeah, for myocardial infarction. For angina, unstable angina, there's no clot formation. It's just narrowed arteries. Does that make sense?
Yeah, from what?
Atherosclerosis buildup in the intimolar, the artery.
Them are.
Yeah,
atherosclerosis, but one is a broken one.
So MI is a broken plaque, angina and unstable angina, just narrowing from atherosclerosis and plaque.
Got it, okay.
Yeah, MI would be ruptured plaque. Yeah.
What actually causes the pain in
the brain? It's a lack of blood flow, and when you get a lack of blood flow, it starts to hurt. Just like if you were to put a blood pressure cuff on my arm, and you know, pump it up to 250 millimeters of mercury, the end of my arm would start to hurt because it's ischemic, right? It would start to really hurt over time. That's ischemia. So it would hurt here, but it would hurt here distal where the blood flow has been cut off. Yeah. Any other questions about it? No? Okay.